meeting of Parliament, Thursday, the 23rd of September, 2021. Order of proceedings. Answers to oral questions continued. Question number 259 for 2021. Leon DJ Bassini. Government advisors of this or credit finance company limited or any other government owned or controlled entity, including the Gibraltar Development Corporation, are providing any loans in respect of the redevelopment of the collector, the collection of the collector hotel, where the collector collector hotel is set out in the order paper. Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister. And Mr. Speaker, no loans are being provided in respect of the redevelopment of the collector hotel. This is what the Chief Minister is asking. I can't immediately think of any, but can the Chief Minister apply the crisis to where they are, or is there any other form of financial assistance coming from government to government and from some entities at all?
May I suggest at the moment, because we have another problem with the event, we're trying to sound. It sounds very low, so we need to reach this for a short period of time. Thank you.
The technical problems seem to have been resolved. We hope we can proceed with the next question. Question number 260 of 2020, the Honourable Kenneth Bradley. We can respond with the condition of racial safety. Can the government advise the projected or contracted cost of moving rubble from the east side mound to the reclamation site of the tall keys and how long that project is expected to take? Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 261 and 262. Question number 261 of 2021. The Honourable Chief of the Party. Jesus, given the practice of supplying the church is the promotion material, are being burned by the government, is it still the government's intention to grant the developer a lease for 50% of the northernmost side of the reformed plot? And if so, why?
Question number 262 of 2021. The Honourable Carlos Padre.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise that it still intends to lend $50 million to the developers of the Tour Keys?
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, under the present arrangement, the extraction of the rubble from the east side and its closing at Colon Island is under the Victoria Keys developers' remit. It is therefore not possible to provide an indication of the estimated cost for doing so, other than the government's own internal view of what that cost might be. As was indicated in the environmental impact assessment for the project, it is anticipated that the creation of the land will take 2 years to complete. In relation to question 261, the answer is yes. The reason is because under the present arrangement, the lion's share of the investment required is offered by the developer, and that far exceeds the estimated value of government contribution in rubble. And as the government of Gibraltar does not intend to run $50 million to the developers of Victoria Keys, as honourable members will know, the reformation of the Victoria Keys site is now being carried out in two separate phases. The first phase of the reformation is being carried out directly by Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar at Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar's cost. This phase will allow the government to move part of the east side rubble mound in order to make way for the continued development of a sand and scenery territory, the affordable home scheme that is set to house both up to 700 Gibraltarian families. This step has been taken by the government in order to expedite the development of expansion to the territory, given the importance of this project to our community and the prospective homeowners who are clearly awaiting their new affordable homes. The remainder of the reformation of the Victoria Keys site will be carried out by the developers of the Victoria Keys at the developers' cost and on the terms that were previously announced. These terms envisage that Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar will lend an amount to the developers that is equivalent to the cost of the remaining reformation, and this lending will be on a fully secured and interest-bearing basis. Clearly, this reformation will be smaller, given that phase one will be undertaken by the government, and the amount envisaged to fund this will therefore be significantly reduced.
Speaker, I have a number of supplementaries, if I might know, because the Chief Minister's answer is quite wide-ranging. In relation to 260, which is about the projected or contracted cost, and he said, I can't really estimate what the cost will be because it's had to develop its cost, but I can only give a sort of guesstimate in the context of the government's own internal cost of it. What is the government's internal costing of it?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman will forgive me for not wanting to share that information widely. I'm very happy to have a conversation with him about it. But this is part of the commercial negotiation between us and the commercial party that we're negotiating with. And we have tenders, different parties have different tenders out to ensure that we get the best prices available for the parts that we're each going to be moving. And it would not be in the best interest of the taxpayer at this stage to give out the government's own internal questions of what that would be, but I'm very happy to have a conversation with him about that. He will understand, Mr. Speaker, that I think it would not be in the interest of the taxpayer at this stage, for the reasons I said, that I should give out that figure.
I accept that. He's mentioned a couple of times at this stage, so it may be that the point comes in future when tenders are awarded where the government can share, perhaps not just privately, but publicly, its own assessment of the cost and so on. And so I'd be grateful if the honourable member can confirm that. But moving on, I'll just roll it up with another question, if I may, because I think hopefully that the answer to that question is uncontroversial. In terms of the of 262, which is if the government, I asked that the government confirm whether it's going to lend $50 million, and the government said no because it's in two phases. First phase is is going to be done by the government. Second phase is going to be done by the developers, and the government is going to lend and at an equivalent amount to allow that to happen. The last time we asked the question about this, the answer was that the government was in discussions with the developers. I take it from the answer the Chief Minister has given that those talks have concluded. Am I right in making that assumption that the talks have concluded, so that the Chief Minister has been able today to advise the House that, in fact, there is this notional agreement to split up the reclamation in two phases? I'd be grateful to have his confirmation of that, and does he have some kind of idea of the cost of the second phase?
Mr. Speaker, I'm happy to deal with those two questions in turn. The first was whether the government would agree that in future we would be able to publish the cost or the estimate that we have of the movement of rubble. I'm very happy to confirm that we would be prepared to do that once we have finalised the arrangements with the commercial parties that would be relevant here, both for us and for the Victoria Consortium, and have arrangements already agreed with the contractors. That is not controversial, and I'm very happy to have a discussion, as I said already before that time, with the Honourable Gentleman on the basis of the information I would give him the commercial and confidence information of the government at this stage. And the second question that he's asked, Mr. Speaker, which is whether the negotiations with the Victoria's partnership or consortium have already been finalised, and can I give an estimation of what the second phase of the Victoria's will now cost, given that it's now split into two phases? The answer is that the conversations are ongoing, but they are not yet concluded, and therefore there is not yet a final determination of the figures that the Honourable Gentleman would wish me to be able to share with him today, because the pre-wrapping of the exercise between phase one and phase two is not yet something that is complete.
And Mr. Speaker, in the open to 2%, where we asked that given the cost of supplying the reclamation material being borne by the government, why is it that, you know, is it still the government's intention to give the developer at least a 50% of the northernmost part of a reclaimed plot? I'm not really sure, given the wide ranging answer that the Chief Minister gave, and a fairly sort of generic way that he described it. I'm not really sure we understand on this side of the House the rationale that he explained on, and I would invite him to perhaps give a more extended explanation of it. As we see it from this side of the House, the government's taking on board supplying the reclamation material and indeed doing the first phase of that, as he explained in the subsequent question. Why is it then that we are still stuck in the original arrangement that the government published in April 2019, which would result in the developers being granted a lease of 50% of the northernmost part of the reclaimed land, not having done what the government had explained in 2019 the developers would do?
Well, I don't think the Honourable Gentleman has understood my answer. Let me try and see whether I can take his invitation to explain in a slightly fuller way the context I was trying to get across. In 261, the Honourable Gentleman says, given the cost of supplying the Victoria Queen's reclamation material are being borne by the government. That's the first phrase of the question that we answered. That needs to be understood, Mr. Speaker, to represent what it means. The cost of supplying the Victoria Queen's reclamation material means having rubble available which can be taken by the developer from the site where it is to Victoria Quays and dumped in the sea to create Victoria Quays. So the cost of supplying the Victoria Quays reclamation material means simply having rubble available that we need to get rid of. So the government is not being put to cost in the step of supplying the Victoria's reclamation material. But of course, I'm always reminded of the fact, Mr. Speaker, that this now referred to as reclamation material is also the level from the East Side Mound that is prescribed by the Honourable Gentleman in that different way in question 260. Is the rest in theft of reclamation on the east side, which Honourable Member is referring to 1996, and also, of course, Mr. Speaker, Sovereign Bay, which is how we used to describe that rest in theft of reclamation on the east side, although it looks exactly the same, but the only difference is that they were in government, and of course, the Halcyon spectacles were in, the rest of the spectacles on. So, in trying to answer the Honourable Gentleman, as honestly as I can, what we're saying is, Mr. Speaker, what the government is doing is saying, oh, for goodness sake, take the rubble. What the developer is doing is suffering, and I use this word in my first answer, and I imagine the Honourable Gentleman has understood now why I use that word, suffering the cost and work of collecting that rubble, processing that rubble, because you can't just put rubble into the sea these days, transporting it to the area of Coron Island, dumping it in the sea with all of the cost that is involved in a dumping of processed rubble into the sea, and thereby creating the reclamation, which will be known as Victoria 2. So the government, Mr. Speaker, is inanimate. We have got the rubble, we have now stopped more rubble from arriving, other than from personal work from home, but constructive rubble now has to be dealt with by some constructors. And the developer is the one that has to suffer all of the steps that I have described. So that was the thinking that I explained to the House, Mr. Speaker, when we first announced security. The fact that it's now in two phases, Mr. Speaker, means that there has to be a renegotiation. I told the Honourable Gentleman there has to be a renegotiation. I told the Honourable Gentleman my starting point in the renegotiation, the reclamation that we created, 100% ours. It's our rubble, it's our water, it's our work. They do another part of the reclamation. Okay, we have arrangements in respect of that reclamation. And I prefaced my answer, Mr. Speaker, by saying, under the present arrangement. And I told the Honourable Member that we were in the process of renegotiating the arrangement for all of those reasons. And I hope that he will agree with the reasons that I've given the House why this could be renegotiation and why, Mr. Speaker, the original arrangements were the ones which were relevant and the whole definition was being recreated in that way, and why there might be different arrangements.
Speaker, I think the last time we had an exchange on the Rubble Mountain, well, last time I spoke, I described it as the Rubble Mountain, the Honourable Member made pretty much similar comments on Sovereign Bay, and I think we agreed across the floor of the House because I tended to him the offer that I would describe it as Sovereign Mountain in future. And may I say, I mean, I take the bad comments he's made in relation to Sovereign Bay under advisement, but I suppose the same could be said about the times that the government that he leads presented glorious projects in relation to the East Side, which haven't come to fruition either, and still remain a rent-infested, invested rubble mountain. Blue water comes to mind, of course, as a sterling example of that. Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Honourable Member's explanation. As I understand it, the really, if I can put it this way, the section and carrying of the glorious Rubble Mountain that will at last be put to some kind of commercial use and will lay the foundations of the territories is going to be paid at the cost of the developer. Does the Chief Minister and the government have an idea of the cost of transportation per ton of rubble, or is this something that is part of the tendering process in relation to the first of the three questions?
Mr. Speaker, I of course recall that the Honourable Gentleman tendered another grant and said that from now on, in order to ensure that we are If we didn't have to have these exchanges, he would refer to this area, as I might call it, that country, as a sovereign mountain. But the Lukasu didn't refer to sovereign mountain, Mr. Speaker. His question, despite his entreaties that we might settle our differences in respect of this area, on the basis of that nomenclature, his questions referred to different things. One referred to the rebels in the East Side Mound, the other one to the reclamation materials, perhaps there the recognizing a value to it, Mr. Speaker. And so he was not true to his word that he would refer to it as the Southern Mountain, and even now, Mr. Speaker, he's once again moving the voters, because only he knows how to do, by suggesting that he will now refer to it as the Blue Water Mountain or the Blue Water Mound or whatever it is, Mr. Speaker. You know, I'm voting, Mr. Speaker, to ensure that as soon as possible, that area becomes a usable area that we're able to find a country that is able to deliver a project there for Gibraltar, not least, Mr. Speaker, for the residents of Catalan Bay, who have only seen that area grow in accumulation and not seen it flatten as they would wish to see, because it is, of course, a nuisance to them. And Mr. Speaker, the government continues to work as hard as previous governments to make that project a real deliverable. And I have no doubt, Mr. Speaker, that I have the support and encouragement of members opposite to make that project a reality, particularly now in these difficult economic times, that would be something very good indeed for Gibraltar. And in terms of the context of the movement of that rubble, the government does have an indication of the cost of the movement of rubble. Honourable members, I think we know that we had tenders out for movement of rock to make the rock armour in the area of Curling Island sufficiently robust to be able to take the dumping of the rubble that would be made available there for the purposes of starting phase one of Victoria Keys and delivering the flatlands that we need to deliver phase two of Victoria Keys, a Constantine Utility. But Mr. Speaker, those funds are not yet fully awarded. We're still negotiating, and the difficulty, of course, with sharing information about an unawarded tender across the floor of the House is it impedes the government's ability to negotiate the best deal for the taxpayer. Again, I'm very happy to obtain the exact detail of the tender submitted from the Chief Technical Officer and to share that with the Honourable Gentleman at this stage confidentially and in future to make the final awarded price known publicly.
Mr. Speaker, final question on this. Chief Minister indicated in the original first question, and indeed he's now said again, that they have an idea of the length of the project. In relation to the question that I asked at 260, how long is the project expected to take in relation to the reclamation? I think the Chief Minister said 2 years. Can I ask him two questions, which is, 2 years from when, does the government have an idea of, have we got information as to when the project will start? And can we make the assumption that when he says it's 2 years in respect of the transport of the rubble to the reclamation site of Victoria Keys, that is the removal of the mountain, without a descriptive nomenclature of whether it's one project or another, is the removal of the mountain also going to be 2 years, or is it going to be a longer period? I think probably the people of Catherine Bay would be interested in that answer.
I imagine the people of Catherine Bay and the people of the Western Gibraltar would be interested in that answer, and that's why that information was already put into the public domain in detail with method statements attached in the EIA proposal that went before the Development and Planning Commission. And Speaker, it's 2 years to create the reclamation. So that is the period that is envisaged under the present arrangement for the footprint that is presently envisaged for Victoria Key.
Next question.
Question number 263 of 2021. The Honourable Kaya Sotari.
Mr. Speaker, how many pending applications for ID cards are there at 13th September 2021, broken down by nationality of applicant and by length of time since the application was submitted?
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer the 264 at this time.
Question number 264 of 2021, the Honourable Kaya Sotari.
Mr. Speaker, what policy issue is government considering in relation to so-called self-sufficient applicants, but it's below the issue of blue ID cards?
Question number 265 of 2021, the Honourable Kaya
Sotari. How many applications for blue ID cards have there been since the 1st of January 2021, and of those how many have been granted or refused? And how many were pending at the 13th of September 2021?
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as at the 13th of September 2021, the civil status on registration office have 129 pending applications for identity cards, which are all in the process. Normally, the turnaround for these types of applications is 10 to 12 working days after submission. But due to the great influx of applications received post-Brexit, coupled with new entry requirements imposed by the Spanish authorities with regard to the non-stamping of passports as registered to Bulgaria, this has resulted in delays in the process. Therefore, these are now taking approximately 15 to 20 working days. Government has detected a possible abuse of the self-sufficiency rule since the end of the Brexit transitional period. This concerns notably persons who seek self-sufficient status merely or principally to be able to avail themselves of free education, including tertiary education funding, without payment of both or either of social insurance or income tax, as well as qualifying for permanent residency and naturalization. Government is seeking ways to tighten the system in the post-EU context, but being mindful also of ongoing discussions with the EU for future treatment. There is no such thing as a blue ID card. The civil status and registration office identity cards are issued to persons eligible under Schedule 1 of the Civilians Registration Office. The remaining residents are issued with civilian registration cards. There have been 3,697 applications received for civilian registration cards from the 1st of January 2021 to the 13th of September 2021. Of these, 2,737 have been granted. There are 503 applications which have been refused, mainly as a result of online applicants who have either applied for the incorrect card type, applied incorrect supporting documentation, or submitted photographs that do not meet the required standard. There are currently 457 pending applications for civilian registration cards. Normally, the turnaround for these types of applications is 20 to 22 working days after submission. As I've already stated, however, Mr. Speaker, our departure from the European Union has resulted in an increase in the number of persons applying for residency in Gibraltar. The processing of these applications is more complex, given that the applicant's eligibility to resident needs to be determined and certain checks have to be carried out in relation to accommodation, employment, etc. These applications require careful scrutiny.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for that information. If I can just ask a number of questions in respect to that. I hear what the Chief Minister says about the post-Brexit effect on delays in the processing of ID cards going from a normal turnaround of 10 to 12 working days to 15 to 20 working days. I have to say that that may be the case with some, even many of the cards, but there are a number of people who come and speak to members on this side of the house where they suffer greater delays. So I think people out there might be surprised to hear that the information being given by the Chief Minister and to the Chief Minister by the Department is that within 20 working days things are being processed. There are examples of people waiting much, much longer, even when it does not give rise to the policy issue that the Honourable Member has alluded to. So I don't know if the Honourable Member has information, and I often doesn't have information of a more detailed nature in respect of the breakdown of the length of time of the processing of those applications, because I'm not sure that the question that we asked specifically, first of all, was answered in terms of nationality of the applicant, and secondly, we would be interested to have more information if the Chief Minister has it to hand in respect of the processing of these applications.
Well, Mr. Speaker, let's try and break down what the Honourable Gentleman is asking about. The Honourable Gentleman says that, that he has people visit him who say that they are waiting longer than 15 to 22 working days for ID Plus. And I wonder whether that is now. I mean, certainly, earlier in the year, we went through a very difficult period because we were in a lockdown, and the second lockdown in which it went into this year. I understand that at one stage, these machines which print our very secure identity cards needed upgrading, and there was a period when we could not get the upgrade carried out because the German engineers from Mobile could not travel to Gibraltar, the upgrades could not be done remotely. So if the other gentleman was spoken to by a constituent in May, that may have been true, because there may have been periods where we were labouring under the inability to print identity cards. It may be clear that we are dealing with some cases where people are disappointed that they haven't had their cards, but they are being told that they need to submit a new photograph because the photograph they've submitted does not comply with the requirement, or another piece of information required is in the problem category. So what I described to the Honourable Gentleman was a difficulty to all the experience. Not the policy issue. And I urge the Honourable Gentleman not to confuse the policy issue with the problem with an application, which can be fixed with some submission of new photographs, etc. Because the Honourable Gentleman said those who are not in the policy. Those who are not in the policy are not granted. They are told they're not going to get their ID card, or their ID card is in a category that is being reconsidered. So those are not issues. But to give him a little bit more information, Mr. Speaker, the total number of cards that have been produced from the 1st of January, to take a barometer, to take a benchmark, because that's the benchmark in his question, to the 13th of September, which I believe is the date on which questions were submitted, total number of cards, both ID cards and civilian registration cards, have been 7,421. That's probably more than in any year since we introduced the identity card, and they were then produced, obviously, the 32,000-odd were produced at that time. To give him another piece of data, the number of cards awaiting collection at the moment is 917. So, Mr. Speaker, I think that it's not that the department is failing to produce them in the time that is available. To give him another piece of information which has been shared with me, and I have to share with the Honourable Gentleman, the number of applications received in that period, 7,421, relates in part to applications received before the 1st of January, but I'm giving him the number of cards produced since the 1st of January. The number of applications received since the 1st of January for both ID cards and for the registration cards is 6,617. 4,790 have been granted, 1,698 have been refused, and 129 are pending because of problems that have arisen. So, Mr. Speaker, in the context of the turnaround, yes, there was a delay earlier in the year. There isn't a delay now for those that submit the documentation that is required from them in keeping with the requirements. There are policy areas, those are separate, but the turnaround of cards, I think, is something for which the department should be commended, given the numbers that they have had to deal with in this extraordinary year.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the issue of the self-sufficient policy point, which the Honourable Chief Minister has answered, can you, I take it that the 129 that are pending, some of those might be affected by the policy issue, I don't know, but I'm asking, does he have an idea of how many applications are affected by the policy issue? Firstly. Secondly, when will the government be able to determine the policy issue? And thirdly, insofar as the way that he described the policy issue, which is that the government has detected a potential abuse that people might be seeking ID cards to obtain certain benefits that are not paying tax and social insurance, to the extent that people are paying tax and social insurance, is it expected, therefore, that those people who are paying tax and social insurance will obtain an ID card, because they are within the policy of the Chief Minister described loosely in his original answer.
Mr. Speaker, I know the Honourable Gentleman wrote to me about somebody's consultation about the question. I'm not going to say a constituent because I don't think somebody can be a constituent, properly so called, unless they are resident and eligible to vote. I don't know whether the word constituent includes those who are not in the franchise. If they're not in the franchise, they can't really formally be a constituent. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't all each be available to people who find themselves in Gibraltar and who have an issue. I don't think I can properly call them a constituent. Mr. Speaker, I don't have the exact information of how many of the 129 that have been refused are refused on the self-sufficiency basis. I can get that information, I'm sure. If somebody is paying tax and social security, and that's the question that the Honourable Gentleman asked me, then they would not come within the head of the self-sufficiency policy. Somebody who wants to take residence on the basis that they are self-sufficient will tell us that they don't pay tax, and they may also tell us that they shouldn't pay social insurance, whatever their personal circumstances may be, their age, etc., etc. So, the answer, Mr. Speaker, I believe, to the Honourable Gentleman's question, without delving further into the detail of immigration law, is that if somebody is paying tax and social security, they will have their civilian registration documentation issued, despite the consideration that the government is giving to the self-sufficient status, because this person would not come within the criteria that the government is trying to better determine.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for your answer because it does provide that reassurance that the Chief Minister is right, that I have written to him about a particular family in facing that situation. It's not appropriate to discuss the case across the House, but certainly to the extent that there are people out there who feel or have been advised, perhaps, that a policy issue is somehow affecting their applications, but to the extent that those people are paying tax and social insurance, the Chief Minister has clarified, and I think it's welcome to hear, that is not the issue that the government are concerned about. The government are concerned about people who are not paying tax and social insurance, as I understand it. Yes, I will do that.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that's right. But I just want to make sure that he's understood the nuance that I've introduced into the answer. Tax and social insurance. So, very different, Mr. Speaker, somebody is just purporting to pay social insurance. because then there isn't employment. With tax, there is employment or self-employment and social insurance. Okay? But without tax, there may be just voluntary contributions of social insurance. Then there isn't employment. And that is an area which is being considered. And therefore, we need to see that conjunctive element that he's introduced, tax and social insurance, is what takes the application out of the problem category for the government. When you're left with no tax and voluntary contributions of social insurance, that's when you're in the field of self-sufficiency. And then, Mr. Speaker, the issue is whether you are creating the concept of free movement as under the European Treaty, where somebody has the right to establish themselves, even though they will not be in employment. And that's the key issue which the government is considering.
Okay, Mr. Speaker, I get the nuance, but let me ask you in this way to see if I understood how the government are landing on the policy issues. To the extent that someone is registering as self-employed and paying tax and social insurance, even though they are working from Gibraltar and not perhaps in Gibraltar, such a person presumably would not fall within the self-sufficiency policy concern. Is that correct?
If a person is not working in Gibraltar, they cannot register as self-employed in Gibraltar. Gibraltar's registration for self-employment is for employment in Gibraltar. And there would be taxation upon the income derived in Gibraltar. So if somebody is employed outside of Gibraltar, even on their own account, it's different to being self-employed in Gibraltar, because they would have to be registered for that employment in that other place.
Mr. Speaker, I would like to put to the Chief Minister whether perhaps he concurs that it is actually the operational and logistic arrangements right now at Gibraltar Hotel House, where the Office of Civil Status and the application has been moved as a result of COVID, not Brexit. And I would like to ask him why the normal area hasn't reopened and if he has any suggestions as to when they will, because my experience where I have been going quite often recently for personal reasons, and my experience is that there are more crowds, not less, and that the staff seems very crowded in effectively, and that perhaps that could have something to do with these delays. Thank you.
The advice the government has is that that has absolutely nothing to do with the delay, and that a collection counter has been made available at the northern entrance to Gibraltar Hotel House, open on Monday to Friday from 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m., which I assume is the area that the Honourable Lady is referring to, and this is what we have done on the advice of that department.
Question number 266 of 2021, the Honourable K.F. O'Brien. Mr. Speaker, did Spain discuss the pilot project on electronic reading of passports that is currently running on the other side of the frontier with Gibraltar?
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer the Chief Minister of the Secretary.
Question number 267 of 2021, the Honourable Kela Sopagi.
Mr. Speaker, the government is aware of any discussions that they might have with Frontex in relation to the Gibraltar Frontex.
Question number 268 of 2021, the Honourable Kela Sopagi.
Mr. Speaker, has the government had any direct discussions with Frontex, or have there been any indirect discussions with Frontex via the UK in which the government has participated or of which the government are aware?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
And Mr. Speaker, neither Spain nor Gibraltar discussed with the other a respective process for the electronic reading of a passport at the frontier between Gibraltar and Spain. Of course, Mr. Speaker, just as an aside, those relate to what would happen in the context of a no negotiated outcome. In relation to the Spanish project, we understand that this is a project that is being conducted at all Schengen external borders throughout the entire Schengen area. The treaty that we are seeking to negotiate with the EU will mean that the land border we share with Spain would not be treated as a Schengen external border for immigration purposes. The governments are aware that informal discussions have taken place between Spain and Frontex, not in relation to the Gibraltar frontier of the personnel, but as the Frontex operation at the port and airport. Informal and very preliminary discussions with Frontex involving Gibraltar representatives have also taken place. As honourable members will have seen, Frontex officials have made statements publicly also.
Mr. Speaker, when the Chief Minister says that he's aware of informal discussions as to the Frontex operation at the port and the airport, he's aware in terms of he's received a direct briefing on that by say, the UK, or from that information by Spain, or from official circles, or is this a more informal kind of trickle down of information?
No, Mr. Speaker, we have been formally advised by Spain that we have undertaken those preliminary discussions with Frontex for the purposes of teeing up the possibility that we are seeking to negotiate in the UK-EU treaty.
And Mr. Speaker, the nature of these discussions is to do with what? Is it to do with structure and mechanics of potential Frontex operations where there to be a treaty? Is the government content with the potential involvement of Frontex as it has been described to it, were in turn discussed with Spain at these informal discussions?
And Mr. Speaker, I think I told the House before, it was the government of Gibraltar that proposed Frontex instead of Spanish law enforcement agencies. And the information that we have been provided with by Spain in the context of discussions alongside the United Kingdom has been that they have been informally ensuring that the arrangements that would be proposed would be ones that Frontex would be able to undertake, both in terms of structure, jurisdiction, in terms of legal jurisdiction, and what might have to be done in order to ensure that if there were a treaty along the lines of the New Year's Eve Agreement, which is the only treaty that the United Kingdom and Gibraltar are countering, that the work that Frontex, if it's envisaged, would be doing there is work that they could effectively discharge.
And Mr. Speaker, all these discussions with Frontex, obviously, as the Chief Minister has himself said, is in the context of the potential development along the lines of he aspires to is something along the lines of the New Year's Eve Agreement and a possible treaty. And I appreciate that this is a sort of rather more extended supplementary, but given what he's said and the nature of the importance of that to Gibraltar, is he in a position today to give any further information as to the possible start of those discussions which I know we're awaiting the approval of the mandate, but does he have any further information that people might want to hear as to that progress?
Well, I know the members of the state that this is exclusively the highest priority on the terms of the New Year's Eve Agreement. I thought we all aspired to it on the basis of being safe and secure, which are the statements that he has made before. Exactly. Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid I am unable to give any information to the House which I believe is reliable enough to want to share publicly at this stage. There is a lot of work going on behind the scenes to try and now bring to a head the potential commencement of negotiations yesterday, the Minister for Europe, Wendy Morton, gave evidence before the European Scrutiny Committee and House of Commons in London, and put in the public domain the information that is available for both the United Kingdom and Gibraltar, which I've already shared, I think, widely in Gibraltar. We anticipate that it may be possible to see the European Union formally adopting its mandate in coming weeks. We will have to see what its formal mandate, when adopted, says, in particular in relation to Frontex. And then, Mr. Speaker, I imagine that we will be able to also, if the mandate is as we anticipate it will be, then we will see whether we can also soon see a timetable for the negotiation agreed between the United Kingdom and the European Union so that we can start to formally take forward the attempt to ensure that we have a new Union's agreement translated into that safe and secure treaty that we all wish to see.
Answers to written questions?
Mr. Speaker, can I just bring a point of order so I'm clear? Because I was having a look at the rules. So there are a number of, before the Chief Minister lays on the table answers to written questions, for clarification perhaps, there are a number of outstanding oral questions that were tabled. As I understood the rule, but I'm looking to Mr. Speaker for guidance. I'm not, obviously, questions can be converted into written form. As I understand the rule, if we wanted to deal with oral supplementaries, we would need to retain them as oral for the next session of the House, unless Mr. Speaker is going to rule that written answers can be delivered to us, and we then have an ability to ask supplementary should we choose to do so in respect of some of the questions. I don't mind which format we follow. As I read the strict rule, I thought we had to have a sort of reflection over 3 days as to whether or not we wish to convert. But I will in your hands, either way would work for us.
I may assist the government. The government is not going to pretend to give honourable members written answers to the questions that they have not been able to ask orally, but which they submitted as oral questions. We're going to now lay on the table the written answers only to the written questions that were asked. They asked some questions which were for written answers, and so we'll lay on the table now those answers to written questions. The remaining questions, which remain as oral outstanding questions, but ministers are not here to answer them because of the Commonwealth Parliament Association and other ministerial travel. I mean, in one instance, Mr. Bassoon has been in touch with the Deputy Chief Minister also about other circumstances. They then have the choice of deciding whether they wish to have as oral questions this time or written questions, and we will then send the written questions. They're not tabled, I think they're sent through the House. So that they then have them as written answers if they wish, but rather than pretending to give written answers to all the outstanding questions of the state.
Nor was I suggesting that the Chief Minister was about to do that. All I was saying is that because we were on the oral questions part of the agenda, before we go to written, tabling of written answers, can I clarify the speaker? I wasn't suggesting that the Chief Minister was about to sort of ambush us with written answers to oral questions. He's not of those things, but not of that. Certainly not today.
Yes, absolutely. The honourable member has a choice. Are you upset? Written answers to all the questions that have not been answered. Or you have within 3 days, at the end of the session, to exercise an option where you want to put those questions back into the system for the next regional health.
No. In the context of what the Chief Minister said at the end, in the context of that, it's not that we're going to get advanced notice of the written answer, presumably. No, exactly.
No, I understand. No, you haven't.
Yes.
But once you take a written answer to an oral question, you can't say,
I was just trying to get a conversation because I often have to speak with the speakers of life in the respect for the time span between questions. And sometimes I think that some of the questions I have favored with the minister is not something that is going to be answered. If I accept those as written, and should I have any question arising out of that, which would have been taken orally, would have been a supplementary, would Mr. Speaker allow me to pose a question, or I have to wait a certain time before I can ask further clarification on the reason I was given? I don't want to, when I'm trying to call myself, if I accept the reason answer, and I don't want to have a
I think, sometimes exercise some discretion, but once you accept a written answer, it means that it's a complete answer. Because you have the option to ask the question next time round. But once you accept a written answer, then the 6 months will kick in.
Mr. Speaker, in legal terms, the Honourable Gentleman is put to his election whether he wants a legal or a moral or written answer. Mr. Speaker, your ruling is your ruling. I would simply ask that perhaps we reflect a little on whether, if an answer is given in writing, it is caught by the 6 month rule. Because I believe that rule is for all questions, and it would be an oral question, but the minute it's converted to writing, then written question rules might apply to that question and the answer. And I'm conscious that. The 6 month rule is in order not to have the same debate across the floor of the House all the time. But when we introduce written questions with your assistance in your time as clerk, you'll recall that we sometimes ask the same written question all the time in order to avoid the statistical questions. And those questions are therefore passing in writing. Sometimes, in very few seldom occasions, the honourable members, when they were here and deciding how actually had a meeting of the House within 6 months, we would ask the same question twice. So perhaps it's an issue in which Mr. Speaker might exercise some discretion that is appropriate. And
I'm quite happy to accept the chairman's guidance. If there are a reasonable number of referrals to the written question given, hand it out this time out, and prepare to accept. This is what the chairman has just said.
Mr. Speaker, let's be clear. Let's be clear. What we're talking about is the tabling of questions, not supplementaries. There would be no way for honourable members to ask a supplementary on a written question. But I'm saying is that it would, in our submission, not be outside the rule for an oral question to be submitted by honourable members for the next session, which goes with the same subject matter on which they've had a written answer. Because the rule about 6 months doesn't formally apply to the written questions, and the oral questions, when converted to written questions, become written questions, subject to written questions. But perhaps we'll take this all offline before we need all the audience that we might have left.
Okay, but your honourable member gets well and before your Mr. Speaker finally rules on it.
I certainly understand where the Chief Minister is going. What we understand on this side of the House is we have the option of either tabling it again as an oral question or accepting a written answer. To the extent that we accept a written answer, we will then be able to have to table oral questions at the next sitting of the House arising from the written answer. As I understand, that is what we're saying, and it will not be caught by 6 months rule, subject to your.
Because they're not supplementary questions, they are new questions. Correct. But if there is any time for this occasion, in respect to the subject of treatment, with
difference. Mr. Speaker, if it applies, it applies because
written answers are not caught by the oral answer rule. So whenever a question that is submitted as an oral question is converted into a written answer, that is when it applies. As a matter of general course.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Speaker, the opposition and the government are in violent agreement.
Mr. Speaker, I now have the honour to table the answers to written questions, number W23 to W45 and 2021 inclusive.
Order of the day. A bill for an act to amend the Petroleum Act to provide for an increase in certain penalties and for connected purposes. The Honourable, the Minister for the Environment, Sustainability, Climate Change and Education. Speaker,
More than 20 liters of petrol to be kept, used or conveyed in a vehicle
except for the permits issued under the rules. Rule 31 prohibits the storage of more than 100 litres on any premises unless they are licensed to do so. Rule 32A closes the gap between the storage of 20 litres and 100 litres on premises by prohibiting the storage of such amounts on any premises unless licensed. The fine that the court may impose for a breach of these rules is increased to a fine not exceeding the greater of 10 times that are fined on the standard scale, which amounts to £100,000, or 50 times the value of the fuel. The term of imprisonment is also increased from 6 months on summary conviction, or 5 years on conviction and indictment, to 10 years. And in addition, where there is loss of life or serious injury, the term is life imprisonment. Mr. Speaker, we have previously highlighted quite apart from the support that second activity lends to the drug trade, the storage of petrol is a dangerous activity which requires suitable premises and suitable containers. The nature of petrol and the fumes of it present a real danger of an explosion and fire. The storage of petrol in unlicensed premises exposes not only the persons concerned, but also the occupants of the adjoining premises at risk. The transportation of significant quantities of fuel carries grave risk, and even a minor traffic accident may turn into an explosion. For these reasons, Mr. Speaker, the government is responding swiftly and appropriately to deal with this problem. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the House.
Before we proceed any further on this bill, I'd just like to advise any members of the Honourable Chief Minister to write to me explaining that this particular bill needs to be certified because it has been taken ahead of the 6 weeks in accordance with Section 35 of the Constitution. If I put the question, does any other member wish to speak on the general principles and rights of the bill?
Mr. Speaker, the Provisions Group will support the bill, and essentially because we agree with the purpose of the bill, we agree that this type of activity has got to come within a bracket that is punished with a potentially punished with a higher penalty. What we're grappling with is with the scheme, which is an existing scheme. We're going to support it, but the minister may actually clarify this for us. And I know that the minister is not a lawyer, but perhaps he's been briefed in relation to this. Section 4 of the bill essentially provides that the clean rules are amended in accordance with the provisions of this section. So what this act does is it amends Rule 38 of the petroleum rules, which contain the offences. So the rules contain the offences, and within those rules, obviously, the offences are punished to a certain degree in the rules. At the moment, what the government is essentially doing is increasing the penalty. Can the minister explain why does the government have to bring a bill to essentially amend what is secondary legislation? I mean, we're just grappling with that. We don't understand that. But as I understand it, all the offences are in the actual rules. There are many regulations that contain offences in a wide variety of areas of the law. That contains the penalty. But why does the government have to essentially amend the penalty by way of primary legislation, when all of this is in secondary legislation?
That is what we're grappling with in relation to this.
The general idea of the number is to speak on the general principles and merits of the bills. Can you give the two
Mr. Speaker, the government was very concerned, as the honourable member has set out, to see that despite having passed legislation to criminalise an activity, to make that a deterrent against that activity, the instances of that activity being pursued in Gibraltar actually increased at the time that we provided that criminalisation. So there was therefore an extraneous circumstance that was driving this activity in the region and in particular in Gibraltar. And Gibraltar tends to ensure, as the government did publicly at the time that we published the bill, that we formed no part of the logistics chain of the nefarious business of drug trafficking. And therefore, that's why we're taking this step, and that's why we're ensuring that the penalties that are provided are penalties which will demonstrate that this House will not tolerate that this activity should be carried out from Gibraltar in support of the drug trade. Now, in order to do that, Mr. Speaker, we have to amend what is the very old Act, the Petroleum Act, dates back to 1931. As a result, Mr. Speaker, rather unconventionally, we're providing in this amending Act the provision for the change of the rules. The reason for that, Mr. Speaker, is that the current Section 7 of the Act does not allow for rules to be made that provide the penalties of this sort. For that reason, all the members will see that we're doing two things. We're amending Section 7 of the Act, and we're then also doing the thing that we would consequently do as a result of that amendment. We need to disapply now Section 23 of the Interpretation on General Clauses Act, which, together with the existing Clause 7, provides a limit on the size of the fine and the length of imprisonment that can be included in subsidiary legislation, and which makes all offences in subsidiary legislation triable only summarily. Mr. Speaker, I hope that explains to the Honourable Gentleman why it's been done in this way. I confess that I was not aware of this level of detail when we asked for the legislation, the draft, and provided us with this explanation, and so when everyone has got up, I knew that I had in my inbox that detailed analysis from the draft as to why we were doing it quite this way, and I hope that's an assistance.
Thank you. The mover of the bill wish to respond?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, just to say that I'm grateful to the Honourable Chief Minister for providing the legal explanation, and I'm grateful to the opposition for supporting this bill.
I will now put the question, which is that a bill came to amend the Petroleum Act provides for an increase in certain penalties and for corrupted practices. Be read a second time. Those in favour? If it is carried,
the Petroleum Amendment Number 2 Act 2021. The Speaker, I therefore would notice that the committee third and third reading of the bill be taken today with all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee third and third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to make provision for the establishment of a register of property occupation, the appointment of a registrar responsible for maintaining the register of property occupation, the creation and appointment of an appeals board, and for connected purposes. The Honourable Minister for Digital, Financial Services and Public Utilities.
People have only to move over the bill for not to make provision to be sent into the registered property occupation. The appointment of a registrar is special to maintain the registered property occupation. The creation and appointment of an appeals board and connected properties be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that the bill for an act to make provision for the establishment of a registrar of property occupation. the appointment of a registrar responsible for maintaining the registrar's property occupation, the creation and appointment of an appeals board, and for the active purposes of the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. Register of Properties Occupation Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, I address the motion to the Register of Property Occupation Act 2021, who read a second time. Mr. Speaker, before I move on to substances of my opening in respect to the bill, I must say that I have endorsed with the members of the opposition following the last sitting of Parliament and in between. I'm grateful to the Honourable Opposition for his detailed comments, which he's emailed me, and he will have seen a letter of amendment consequential upon that, which he has discovered upon. And I will, in my response, after I assume he will speak, deal with the remaining issues that are not covered by that amendment to the legislation. Mr. Speaker, the declaration of legislation is viewed in relation to residential property, which for the purpose of the Act is defined as relevant property. A person occupation residential property devotee will be required to make an application to the registrar in order to have the said property in the zone of the occupier entered in the register. Such person will be required to by deed of occupation as requested by the registrar, including the names of all persons in occupation of the property in common with him, and allow the registrar to inspect the property if so requested. If, however, the property falls under the definition of special housing, as designated under a legal notice, for example, government housing or elderly care living arrangements, the obligation to register falls on the competent authority appointed in the said notice. For example, for the purposes of government housing, referred to as public housing in the Housing Act of 2007, the responsibility to register pursuant to the Act shall lie with the principal housing officer, who in turn shall provide details to the registrar of all occupied properties together with the name of the occupiers. If, on the other hand, property is rented privately, for example, by an estate agent, and the application is made by an occupier, the landlord will be required to provide the registrar with details of occupation upon the request with a very specific time frame, a system of verification. Those who register occupied property for experiencing this act within 3 months to provide details of occupation, or willingly provide source information, or allow inspection of property when requested by the registrar, is a similar fund to the fine of up to level 4, £4,000 on this fund is fair. I will now move to the particular clause of the bill. First, if the procedure sets out the appointment of the registrar by the minister, the registrar shall consider applications and shall also be responsible for maintaining the register, so an accurate and detailed record of property occupation is foreclosed. Clause 7, the registrar's general powers and duties, pursuant to the Act, and these include the different items that are listed therein. Clause 10, for the type of happening that is a change in occupation, in such cases, the occupier must within 1 month, commencing on the date of change, notify the registrar before they exercise his powers under clause 7. Clause 13 establishes the property occupation appeals board, which will hear and determine appeals under the Act. The constitution, composition, and powers and proceedings of the board are contained in the schedule to the Act. The schedule may be amended by legal notice. Following from clause 13, clause 14 grants an aggrieved applicant the power to appeal, which is listed for trial in the registrar's decision, and aggrieved applicant may appeal the decision of the board to the magistrate court. Mr. Speaker, and this is the best, I would further state that the board will engage comprehensive social benefits such as health care and education. Following the Chief Minister's budget address of 2019, we must be vigilant to ensure that such social benefits are not taken advantage of by non-entitled individuals. For example, individuals with eligible properties under some tenancy agreements to engage in the benefit of health care and education. It is expected that the Act will assist the relevant departments in monitoring and containing its abuse, as it aims to identify individuals generally residing in an occupation or expected individual. The Act will make, for example, highlight cases where there is an attempt to register a tenancy against the property that already has an occupier claiming those benefits. The register may also serve other properties, for example, assisting new contracts to provide the confirmation of tax residency in Gibraltar. It must be emphasized that the register is not a public register,
and is totally GDPR compliant in relation to the confidentiality of information that the registrar may hold. I commend the bill to the House. Referring to the question, does any of the members to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The leader of the
Speaker, indeed, the other minister and I did engage while we tabled the bill before the summer break, and we had a discussion after the budget as to certain, at least I flagged with him that we had a number of concerns in relation to the bill. And we agreed that the bill would not be taken before the summer to give us an opportunity to engage with government in respect of those concerns. And certainly, the people who read has provided me with an opportunity to send him a list of requirements. And what I would say, though, having done that and engaged with him in respect of that, certainly from our perspective, having seen the proposed amendment letter that is going to be tabled in at committee stage, we certainly don't see that amendment letter goes sufficiently far enough to deal with the points that we have raised. I appreciate that the Honourable Member did say to me in an email that he would reply in his original second reading contribution, or indeed in reply to me. On the points, and I certainly look forward to hearing him speak to the points that we raised, because the points that we raised were quite wide-ranging, at two levels, really. First, they were granular in respect of certain provisions of the bill in relation to privacy and confidentiality. We wanted to understand the scope of the bill, how it would work in the private sector, whether it would affect MOD housing, how it would affect the private sector, does it place the final obligation on the landlord or the occupier, what impact does it have on the landlord? And we mentioned a whole number of detailed issues in respect of the register itself, the confidentiality provisions, in respect of the flow of information. But Mr. Speaker, we also raised quite significantly the issue of underlying policy, which for us, there can always be improvements to any bill, but we need to get comfortable with the underlying policy. And I did share with the Honourable Member before the summer break that when this bill was first published, certainly on first reading of it, I thought it wasn't immediately obvious what the purpose of the bill was, and it seems to encroach quite significantly on what were traditional freedoms that people would have, from commercial freedoms and indeed private freedoms, in terms of the information that they needed to give the state on the ownership of private property. And then, of course, I did, the legal bill began to cascade that it might have something to do with the curtailment of abuse, and the Honourable Member did send to me, one of the things he did send to me the draft speaking list that he delivered today. But what I did say in reply to him, and it's perhaps something that he needs to expand on, is that the speaking note contains a pretty condensed paragraph in respect of the procurement of abusers. Now, we support the principle, clearly, that people should not be abusing the system and be obtaining benefits when they are not entitled to those benefits. Let me make that absolutely clear. That is where we stand, and if this is essential and necessary, and if there are essential and necessary things that need to be done, well, then they should be done. But the explanation so far has fallen well short of persuading us at that level. I have asked the Honourable Member, is there other mechanisms? Why are the other mechanisms in place already deficient? What else can be done to make sure that that we do not need to legislate in a way that is intrusive? Because clearly this bill is quite intrusive in respect of of the flow of information and management, the obligation that are placed on people, and is there any other way that we can make sure that people do not abuse the system for of the truth? And as I said to the honourable member, I appreciate that this is a philosophical point, philosophical purpose, but it would have been helpful to have a better understanding of the grounding and objective of the bill in that way, and why the government feels that this is the only way that these abuses can be curbed. Certainly from the standpoint and explanations that we have had so far, the ground on which we are right now, so the minister understands where we are, is that having engaged constructively and proactively with government and having shared the points, first of all, we're not sure, I'm quite sure that our points have not been dealt with, just looking at the amendment letter, not all of them have been dealt with, and we haven't had explanations in respect of other points. There may be explanations in respect of other points, but in respect of the most important macro points as to the purpose and objective and whether it can be achieved in a different way so that we do less to encroach on people's freedoms, then we fall short of understanding that the objective, and at the moment are not persuaded to support the bill, and we would intend to explain on it.
The honourable member wishes to speak on the general principles of the bill. The honourable member has come on.
Mr. Speaker, I will be voting in favour of the bill. As in principle, I agree with the merits of the bill, but I'd like to highlight that I don't quite like the idea of granting ministerial powers of exemption by statute, not for this bill and not for any other bill. Even if the subsequent clause in the amendment tries to steer the scope of the exercise of this discretion, we all know that granting political discretion means opening up the door to abuse and corruption. If this register is designed to provide accountability and detailed knowledge of exactly who resides in the book and how properties are occupied, I don't see the need for granting powers of exemption by statute, and definitely not with the wide ground set out by this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
I want to
say that the honourable minister has explained the general principles and purposes on which the government has been motivated to bring this bill to the House, and indicated also some of the elements of the discussion that we've had with the immediate resolution and our response in the amendments that we're moving, and I know they will now issues that take that in respect of the response of the honourable leadership in the scheme. But in terms of the overwhelming importance that this bill has and the purpose of it, this is about joining up a lot of the issues that we find in government when we can see abuse happening. So in terms of how somebody is asked to give information, every leader of the opposition has talked about the curtailment of freedoms, and I think he really is completely barking up the wrong tree here. Gibraltar operates already a system of registered land, and so ownership of land in Gibraltar must be registered in order to be effective. If one's ownership of land is not registered under the property register, then any assertion that the person may make in respect of ownership of that land can only be provided for by trust, and can only be enforced by a court in equity, can't be enforced otherwise. And so requiring people to register their interest in land, such as it may be, is already a provision of our law. We already operate a register in respect of ownership of land. So the first point that he made, I think, Mr. Speaker, is not a point that, on reflection, he would wish to pursue very vigorously. The second point, Mr. Speaker, is that to require someone to tell us where they are living is also something, Mr. Speaker, that is provided for in our law, because our law in respect of civil registration requires that people who are resident in Gibraltar provide an address to the Civil Service and Registration Office
And therefore, both the issue of registration of ownership of real property and the issue of registering for residence in Gibraltar is provided for in our law. So I said to the Honourable Gentleman, he is wrong to suggest that there is any issue here which curtails individual freedom. What we are doing here is because joining up those things so that both ownership and registration of it and residence and registration of residence is joined back also in the property where a person purports to be living. And the issue of speaker that he will understand is an important one for us, in particular given the moment in which we live, but even despite the moment in which we live, is that very often, and he would have come across this when he was in government no doubt, people are using addresses where they are not actually residents for the purposes of enjoying benefits in Gibraltar. And the whole gamut of benefits in Gibraltar, whether it's health benefits, or whether it's scholastic benefits for children, or the funding of tertiary education for their children, to give them just an overview, is done on the basis of, I've got my civil registration card, or I've got my identity card, there's the address I've given, they've accepted it. Now, different government departments speak to check with each other against the information that is provided. There is another bill in the legal paper that we'll be dealing with now, which will enable us, despite the general data protection regulation, to share information between departments, something which we cannot do until the legislature. Okay? But all of that information does not yet provide us with a full picture of what may be happening. And so, for all the government to understand, somebody in one department diligently pursuing these matters can call somebody in another department to say, look, Mr. X has come and told me that he is registered at this address, right, as being resident. And I therefore am going to give him his identity card, which will then unleash all of the benefits. Is that right? Registered and living at this address. The answer is that we have no requirement that anybody be registered as living at an address. So if you put a LPS, for example, in respect of private property, the maximum that you'll be told is who is the owner of that property. The registered legal owner of the property. Not whether they have rented it. Because if they rented it, that doesn't have to feature in what is presently registered. So they're not going to say, look, Mr. Sabagi, landlord in Gibraltar, owns 100 apartments, and they're all in his name. I don't know whether Mr. Conserve is actually resident in Sabagi Towers, apartment number one. Okay? And therefore, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Conserve is resident in Sabagi Towers, number one, he would not be able to connect his electricity, or if he produces his contract, he might be able to, but he might not be able to register his children in school, etc. If he is not resident of Sabagi Towers number one, and in fact, 50 other people are claiming that address as the place where they are resident, we might also not be able to see that there are 50 other people there. And so, this is what we need to do in order to ensure that we stop the abuse and corruption that there is, because abuse and corruption is not something that simply afflicts the political classes in some jurisdictions. So the flips of the class in many jurisdictions. And there is abuse and corruption of the system by people who seek to come to Gibraltar to take advantage of benefits which are provided for the people of Gibraltar and residents of Gibraltar, and unfairly take advantage of them. And so this is the way that we get all of these systems to join up, and we have a very clear understanding of who is in what property, because it will be a legal requirement that we provide that. And the Honourable Gentleman can just assure that after 10 years in government, we have tried every other possible way to achieve this. And it is not possible to achieve it in any other way. And for that reason, Mr. Speaker, I'm sure you will agree with me that this is a purpose that we should pursue, where no liberty is at stake whatsoever, and whether they know where to take the view that there is a liberty and a freedom at stake, then he would be in the class of people who would think that it is an infringement upon one's liberty and freedom to be required to have an identity card, a position which many people take in other jurisdictions, in particular in the United Kingdom, but we do get a person here, we've always said,
it was useful to have an identity card, and it was administratively important for us to have an identity card for the purposes of education, employment, and all other benefits, etc. So, Mr. Speaker, we don't agree that this is intrusive. We do believe that it is necessary. And then, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady, in my view, is entirely wrong to suggest that a ministerial discretion somehow creates an opportunity for abuse and corruption. Our laws are full of ministerial discretion. Because if you think that ministers are the repositories of the public trust, of the trust of the electorate, and ours is our sacred obligation to deploy that discretion and those rights which are given by the people in a way that is not abusive and is not corrupt. And there are laws that would prevent abuse and corruption already in our criminal statute. But if you think that, the other reason is to understand that the creation of a discretion would be entirely irrelevant in the context of controlling abuse and corruption. Because once one is elected by the public to public office, in this house already, because one can abuse the privileges of this house and corrupt the principles of this house, or indeed to ministerial office, one has the ability, if one were corruptible and abusive, to become involved in abusive and corruptive practices. The law giving you a discretion to determine something would be relevant almost in the context of somebody who is ready to abuse and corrupt the system. And I think that although it may be common in TikTok to talk about abuse and corruption, let's be very clear, we're still doing a very serious act, which is legislating, creating a power for a purpose, which is a good and noble purpose, which is to protect the public purse, to protect the interests of Gibraltarians and ensure that the benefits that our society gives to its residents of whatever nationality are given only to its residents of whatever nationality, and yet further, the exemption power, Mr. Speaker, is in fact designed to exempt, for example, and the Honourable Gentleman will be able to give a better example, but to exempt the fact that the governor, who represents Her Majesty the Queen and who therefore is exempt from certain aspects of the laws that apply to most people, might actually have to register because it's a widely drawn act, and it has to be a widely drawn act to ensure that people who are seeking to abuse do not find a loophole. You might have to register. And individuals who might otherwise come within the category of person for everybody in the South, whether they should not be subject to this registration requirement. Individuals, for example, who are serving members of the armed forces of the United Kingdom in Gibraltar, who are under different categories, and who are here in a way that is defined, and we have information there, but they're not under the civilian system, are not provided for, but otherwise the map of Gibraltar is provided. So I would encourage the Honourable Lady not to see this issue through the filter of potential abuse and corruption as she has, and to support this bill constantly, and not arrest her falsely, as she has suggested. She will nonetheless support it. And Speaker, it is important, whether it's in relation to schools, whether it's in relation to the Gibraltar Health Authority, whether it's in relation to scholarships, etc., etc., that everyone who is entitled to those benefits should have them, and that no one who is not entitled to those benefits should abuse or corrupt the system to take those benefits away from those who should have them, and we must protect the public purse by passing this bill to finally ensure that all the information necessary is available to departments for that purpose.
At the end, we move to the fund.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, just expanding on the point that the two things have made in respect of whether this is an intrusive system or legacy. I think the two things have already referred to. For example, the land taxes as an obligation to register. Similarly, CSIRO, if you want to be giving a certain card or an ID card. But then with the health department, the education department, the employment ministry, the reform, tax office, security, DDLA for car licensing or car registration or car ownership, registered birth certain marriage, every single interaction with the government department requires you to give the address. Every single one. So if there has to be a registered reputation, how can that possibly be intrusive? So what we're actually going to be doing is centralizing it into one place
where each of those departments I just mentioned will be able to verify that that person actually lives where they tell us they live. But it will be tricked at first. There will be a formal register which will enable us to know exactly who is occupying what property, and that is the one source that you will go through when you are using government services. Because when you register for e-services, the e-services system will check your address against the registry of property occupation. That is the reason why we're going to be able to use this so effectively in enabling us to believe the areas that we've talked about with far, in a far more efficient and a far more beneficial manner for the taxpayer. Mr. Speaker, the people have also referred to resilience. The ability to exempt an individual or a group of individuals, Chief Minister mentioned the governor, or indeed, for example, the Minister of Defence, whether you choose to. Without this power, we wouldn't be able to do that. And therefore, to give us the state, should we do that, could be security reasons, which allows certain people not to declare the occupation. If that is something that is satisfactory in the public interest, then an exemption is able to be granted. But it would be a very, very limited scope, because the intention is that it would be a complete register. And it would be incomplete if exemptions were given really. But we're supposed to have the ability to do it, to set, for example, for security reasons, somebody failing to comply with our legislation and breaking the law and being eligible for committing an offence. Mr. Speaker, a government member mentioned he did send me a long, detailed list of questions, and I'm very happy to take them through these now, because they all have quite simple answers, which will explain to them why, in fact, there is no further need to amend. And I will explain those briefly as I take you through them. Mr. Speaker, the legislation does cover all residential property, public and private. The public side, the government housing, the public housing is defined in the 2007 Act. What will happen is the principal housing register will give the register a full list of all government housing. And that will not be just at the beginning, which is one of the questions given on the action, but there will be a weekly or bi weekly or however often is needed update in the change. So individuals who live in government housing will never have to go and register. The principal housing officer will do that. Likewise, with the other class of the elderly care homes will be done similarly. So there is no need for anyone else or any other interaction. It will be done by the principal housing officer. The obligation is on the occupier and only the occupier. So Section 14, which you'll remember, refers to Section 14 of the department, the principle that occupier registers, the registrar has the ability to engage with the landlord to check. That's it. There's no other obligation on the landlord. The landlord is not to file each and every occasion. So the registrar needs to have the ability to receive information. Let's say, for example, that two applications for the same property. The registrar will engage with the landlord and say, "Oh, no, who's there? Which one is there?" Perfectly possible, and we know that's been part of the problem in the past. So the third obligation of the landlord will be to confirm to the registrar any questions you may have in respect of who the person is, but only the occupier. Who would have a registration obligation in terms of 50-50 housing? Again, the occupier. There's one person occupation. The government doesn't occupy them. The occupier is even there to have the principal obligation of registering. Who would the government intend to appoint as registrar? Mr. Speaker, it could be an official of Land Property Services, which is the intention to have as a registrar. Is there an information gateway posted first in terms of government authorities? As one of the members, Mary and the Chief Minister just mentioned, on today's order paper is a bill enabling us to do precisely that without breaching GDPR. There is a very similar piece of legislation in the UK enabling the UK government to have communication within government departments without having an each and every occasion to have data sharing agreements between each of the government departments from the same unit. So there will be a gateway, which is the legislation that is about to be passed shortly. This is not a public register. For it to be a public register, the legislation would have to say it is a public register. And so the fact that it is not a public register, not liable to inspection, means that there is no need to state anything other than what is registered, and that's not open for public inspection. The bill could deal with the issue of specifying the confidential information. The advice we received from both the drafts from the government's data protection officer is that the provisions of GDPR apply fully to this bill, as you would expect, and therefore that deals with all the obligations the registrar will have in respect of confidentiality and breach of that confidentiality. And overall, the powers in GDPR, as we all know, are significant and extensive, so there is no need to go any further, and that is what, in fact, we are doing. The previous 4 months, perhaps, is short under Section 4.5. We don't agree. We believe 4 months for registration is ample time for anybody to register. This is not just now at the beginning, but ongoing, so somebody will be required to register within period of taking up the property. I assume that the piece in terms of Section 7 of the does not prevent rental of private property if not registered. No, it doesn't prevent the rental of private property, but that person will be committed a breach of this act if they don't register. So it doesn't prevent, but it creates an effect, if you understand what I mean. How can an application be approved on a temporary or conditional basis? Well, if somebody comes with it with a rental contract for 3 months or 6 months, the registrar would accept and give an issue a temporary certificate for that period of time. They're not going to issue a 12-month or 18-month certificate if somebody's got a 3-month temporary agreement, which is something we are very sensitive of and allow to. So they would be given a temporary registration. In what circumstances would non-registration take place if the property has been already rented? Well, if it's already been rented out to someone else. That's precisely what we are seeking to do. And with that, we do non-registration. We wouldn't accept it. Or if the applicant is an occupation of other property at the same time.
So, the purpose of my question, I'm grateful for the honourable member going to support my questions with the new branch. But so the reason for my question is because it wasn't immediately obvious when you read this bill precisely in what circumstances are being envisaged for this non registration. So if someone doesn't live there, obviously I get that, but it certainly should not be something that, and so if someone does live there, to me, it is inconceivable that it would not be registered, presumably that this is not the purpose of the bill. Is the honourable member accept that?
If somebody does live there, then it's a question of the registrar getting to grips by asking, for example, the landlord as to who in fact is an occupation. But look, the system is going to send an alert to the registrar. For example, there are 10 people. Well, that's ongoing. If there are 10 people in a 20 square metre studio apartment, the system triggers an area of square metres which is allocated per person. So if you get 10 people within 20 square metres, that is a signal saying there's something wrong here, we need to look at this problem. So that could be one of the examples of a non-registration.
In bubbling in my mind, I've got this example, which is actually, in fact, based on an example a number of years ago, right? The person who came to see me never accepted these were the facts, but it occurred to me that these were the facts. And what I want to ask the minister is, who has the obligation to register, and exactly what is the extent of the obligation? It becomes clear when I explain. So, if you take, for example, you have somebody, a family of three, a married couple and a child, they live in Spain. They want their child to go to school here, and what they do is they come to an arrangement with somebody who owns a flat here in Gibraltar, it's a three-bedroom flat, and essentially they say, well, they are renting out to me one of the rooms in this flat. That's another family which has maybe another child. Now, when you come to register, presumably, the head of the family that owns the flat will register his wife or partner and the child Did we have an obligation as well? I'll explain why it's important. Did we have an obligation to also say, well, actually, there is this other couple with their child in one of my bedrooms? Because if you didn't impose that obligation, the problem, of course, is they could both say, the couple number one that owns the flat they register, husband, partner, child, whoever will register, husband, partner, child. But you wouldn't really be able to catch one out, you know what I mean? Because if there was an obligation, you would, if there's an obligation on the owner of the flat to also register and say, well, that's the case, really mean, but I also, there's other couple in their child that are also in occupation. Is this what it contemplates? Does it not contemplate that? That kind of situation, because it appears to me that unless there is an obligation on the actual owner of the flat to tell the truth in terms of who occupies the flat, not only the people that he is responsible, his household, but somebody else that's also in occupation of that one bed, of that bedroom, it becomes, you know, you're still going to have the same problem in identifying thirdly that you have at the moment.
The owner is still on the occupier. The occupier has to register every single person that lives in that property with him. Not the owner. Yeah. So, if he doesn't, let's say somebody's not registered, they can't claim the residence is bought because they wouldn't be able to claim the benefits without which he will go. So, if the occupier doesn't put a firm stood down, in his film, and he would obviously scrutinize that in the registration process, then there's no problem because you can't claim education, health, or any of the benefits of residency brings which you're trying to address.
Is there an obligation on the owner of that flat to not only register his partner and his child, but also the fact that there is this other couple with another child also within that property?
Well, that's more of a policy statement. I believe it explains the reasons for that. So, the reason why we've brought the change that we have is from the point raised by the honourable member, both in the last parliament of the budget session and in this correspondence, we begin with picked up the change that we need to make to cover those points. And the event we haven't, I hope I've explained that I'm good to his satisfaction to enable him to support the bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
I will now put a question which is at a breakdown to make provision for the establishment of a registered property occupation. The appointment of a registrar responsible for maintaining the register of property occupation, the creation and appointment of an appeals board, and for collective purposes to be read a second time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Are members of the opposition voting in favour? The Register of Property for Property Occupation Act 2021.
Before I object to the notice of the committee today, and third reading of the bill be taken today, if there are any amendments to the bill.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee today, and third reading of the bill be taken today? A bill for not to provide for the regulation of the sharing of information, including personal data, between public bodies, to provide for the regulation of the management of information by public bodies, and to provide for related matters. In honourable, the Minister for Digital, Financial Services and Public Utilities.
Mr. Speaker, I have to move the bill for not to provide for the regulation of the sharing of information, including personal data, between public bodies, to provide the regulation of the management of information by public bodies, and to provide the rules of matters to level 14.
I now put the question which is that a bill for act to provide for the regulation of the sharing of information, including personal data, between public bodies, to provide for the regulation of the management of information by public bodies, and to provide for related matters be read a first time. Those in favour? Is the bill carried? The Data Sharing Public Authorities Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, I'm going to read the bill to my right second time. Mr. Speaker, public service delivery is changing. This increasing availability of service will be more efficient and effective when they are ground up. This generates a service that requires the sharing of information. So public authority to access information has another part of the public sector which requires appropriately the powers which are often provided by expressing the gateway to disclose information. The current level data sharing powers for public service delivery are complex. This lack of a clear framework of rules risks hindering the ability of public authorities to offer citizens timely and appropriate interventions and to respond quickly to a changing social and policy environment. This act therefore creates a mechanism to establish a clear and robust legal gateway to enable public authorities to share relevant information on the individuals and families they are working with. That one simply deals with the commencement of interpretation clauses that can consider the terms information and data have the same meaning. It is important to note that personal information in this act has a slightly different meaning to personal data in the devoted GDPR as it extends to body corporates as well. That two of those references to information between specified persons for the purposes of public administration, global public services, reducing public sector debt, combating fraud against the public sector, and for research. The purpose of the debt power for fire is to allow public authorities to enable better debt management, including debt recovery, and connecting the debt owed to a public authority. It is also in all of our interests to be employed, ensuring that taxpayers' money is spent appropriately, and they are taken out of the system accordingly. For this reason, the fourth paragraph 6 allows the public authorities to share data to enable better detection and prevention of fraud against the public sector, as well as recovery of public sector monies. Mr. Speaker, Part 2 of the Act covers general obligations and includes a restriction on disclosure where this is expressly restricted by any other enactment. The open obligation in Clause 10 for the public authorities have regard to any code of practice issued by the Information Commissioner
The Gibraltar Rebel Proposal was recently published with Register on Code of Practice, and before legal and legal rules are available under the text, the public authorities must take this code into consideration, as well as carefully consider whether the code is consistent with this act. The Gibraltar GDPR and the Data Protection Act of 2004. It was intended to ensure, Clause 11, that personal information may only be disclosed onwards in narrowly defined circumstances. The limited circumstances of such information will be disclosed without committing an offence as set out in Clause 2. The Act also contains regulation making powers specifically to allow the Minister to amend the list of specified persons of Clause 1. Only those persons listed in this review are able to disclose information under the Act. The registering powers are permitted powers, which means that those powers, those persons are potentially able to share information, can choose whether or not to do so. Because the writer's objective is intended to allow the data for sharing the data for the purposes of assisting, improving, or facilitating a specific public service limited to an individual household. This includes assisting them with their physical, mental, and emotional well-being, and their social and economic well-being, and their overall living conditions. Both of these objectives give public authorities the ability to gain access to data that they need in order to respond more efficiently and effectively to current and emerging social and economic problems. Mr. Speaker, I commend this to you.
The thank you. The question is only on the member to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill. I'm going to leave your position.
Mr. Speaker, we will support this bill. As I understand it, this is not a bill that is allowing for the first time the sharing of information between departments. I would have expected departments to be speaking to each other, but this is providing a regulatory framework for the communications, which actually is clear, transparent, and with confidentiality safeguards, which are embodied in the bill, and as the other minister has described, so it's a welcome piece of legislation in that sense. So that's the sharing of information that one would have expected in the delivery of public services will be conducted against a statutory framework which safeguards key principles of confidentiality as well. So for that reason, we would support it.
The sharing of data today, since the introduction of GDPR, requires different departments to enter into data sharing agreements, which basically dictate the holder and the process which you adopt and how you hold and how you pass information out. So this does is provide for that, but within one government department provided there is such a platform for the same process to be adopted, which will be found in GDPR.
I'm going to put the question, which is, a better format provided for the regulation of the sharing of information, including personal data, between public bodies, to provide for the regulation of the management of information by public bodies, and to provide for related matters, to vote a second time. Those in favour, those against, carried.
The data sharing public authorities Act 2021.
Mr. Speaker, I would like to note that the committee states in favour of the bill be taken to vote with all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee states in favour of the bill be taken to vote?
A bill for an act to amend the Traffic Act 2005. The Honourable Minister for Transport.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Traffic Act 2005 be read a first time.
Now I put the question, which is, if a bill for an act to amend the Traffic Act 2005 be read a first time, those in favour of the bill carried.
The Traffic Amendment Act 2020. Mr.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. The bill,
Mr. Speaker, amends the Traffic Act 2005.
The bill changes the duration of a learner's license from 3 months to 6 months, and the increased duration of a license is extended in a written provision to licenses that were issued after the 1st of December 2020.
and it will be dealt with in an amendment to this bill. All these changes are in response to the coronavirus pandemic and have been in keeping with the government's social distancing policy. Current figure going forward, the bill also allows the date extending the validity of a law of benefits to be amended by notice in the Gazette, and this will be resulted by an amendment or an adequate state.
So, I will put the question to the general member of the speaker in the general terms of the matter to the bill. Can the only member of the speaker respond? I put the question, which is that the bill came out to member traffic of 2005, is that the second time those in favor or the bill carried? The Traffic Amendment Act 2020.
Mr. Speaker, I have registered notice of the committee stage and third reading of the bill decision today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill decision today?
No.
I beg your pardon, I was not aware this was going to be taken. A bill for an act to make provision for the regulation of the production, import, export, marketing, and supply of cannabis for medicinal purposes and for connected purposes. The Honourable, the Minister for the Environment, Sustainability, Climate Change, and Education.
Thank you.
I have the honor to move that a bill came out to make provision for the regulation of the production, import, export, marketing, and supply of cannabis for medicinal purposes and for commercial purposes be read in the first time.
I want to put a question which is that a bill came out to make provision for the regulation of the production, import, export, marketing, and supply of cannabis for medicinal purposes and for connected purposes, be read a first time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, in discussing the general principles and merits of the bill, it's important to note at the outset that the government has spared no effort in ensuring that this new potential industry is regulated fully in compliance with the United Nations Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs of 1961, as amended from time to time, and I will refer to as the convention. As a result, Part 2 of the bill contains regulatory objectives drawn directly from the preamble to the convention. Part 4 and B make it clear that while the medical use of narcotic drugs continues to be indispensable for the relief of suffering, and that adequate provision must be made to ensure corporate drugs for such purposes, effective measures must be implemented to prevent the abuse of narcotic drugs in accordance with the Convention. Part 2 defines cannabis in accordance with the Convention and in keeping with the Drugs Misuse Regulation 2005, and sets out the different activities that are licensable, including the production, import, export, marketing, and supply of medicinal cannabis. Part 3 delineates the relationship between the bill and the misuse of drugs regime under the Crimes Act of 2011. In effect, the bill takes the licensable activities in relation to the disorder cannabis out of Part 21 of the Crimes Act and establishes a separate regulatory regime. In this way, licensable activities carried out under the bill's licensing regime are exempt from the Crimes Act. It is important to note, however, that any activities that are not carried out in accordance with the bill's provisions, for instance, because an entity does not comply with the conditions of a license, will activate the penal provisions of the Crimes Act. Therefore, the bill establishes the Medicinal Cannabis Commission, which I will refer to as the Commission, which, in the exercise of its function, has a duty to regulate the licensable activities in such a way as to ensure that commercial activity in relation to medical cannabis is carried out in accordance with the regulatory objectives in Clause 4. By virtue of Clause 16, part of the work of the Commission will be to prepare a statement setting out the principles that the licensing authorities and its to the client when exercising their respective functions. Pursuant to Clause 17, the Commission is also responsible to issue one or more codes of practice in respect of the exercise of licensing powers and the manner in which licensable activities are undertaken. In particular, a code of codes must establish criteria to be applied to ensure that, for example, measures are adopted to prevent misuse and illicit traffic in the cannabis plant in accordance with Article 28(3) of the Convention, which deals with the control of cannabis, and that the licensing system achieves the objectives of the Convention relating to manufacture, Article 29 of the Convention, and trade and distribution, Article 30 of the Convention. Further, pursuant to Clauses 19 and 20, the Commission is tasked with ensuring compliance with the licensing regime, investigating whether an offence has been committed, and referring cases to the Director of Public Prosecution for whom to consider whether to institute criminal charges in respect of any offence. The figure I now turn to Part 5 of the bill, which provides for the licensing authority. Firstly, by virtue of Clause 23, it is established that the licensing authority is the collector of customs, or such other fit and proper person that the minister may appoint. At this stage, we think it's important to highlight that the relevant minister, for the purpose of the act, is the minister with responsibility for finance. Given that, in some and essence, the bill regulates the domestic and international trade in medicinal cannabis, it makes sense for the minister with responsibility for customs to also exercise the various functions as set out in the bill. Under Clause 24(1), before taking any decision on the exercise of a function under the Act, the licensing authority must give the minister notice of the decision that it proposes to make. Under Clause 24(2), if the minister considers that the proposed decision would be prejudicial to the economic or other public interest or good reputation of the broker, the minister may direct the licensing authority not to make the decision proposed and to be considered the exercise of expansion having regard to any relevant direction under Clause 25. Pursuant to Clause 24(3), if the minister is satisfied that it is necessary having regard to the economic or other public interest or the good reputation of the broker, the minister may A, direct the licensing authority to make a specified decision, or B, if satisfied that the licensing authority has failed to comply with Clause 24(2)(b), may exercise that function. Under Clause 24(3), the licensing authority may establish and operate a procedure for the giving of decisions in principle as to the exercise of any function under the bill once enacted. Further, under Clause 25(1), the licensing authority must have regard to the general policy of the government and comply with any general directions that the minister provides pursuant to such a policy. It is important to note, Mr. Speaker, that subject to Clause 24(2) and 3,
nothing under 475(1) is to be construed as authorizing the minister to give any direction in respect of a particular license application or any other particular decision of the licensing authority. As this makes provision for the circumstances in which a person commits an offence, including, but not limited to, when a person carries out a licensable activity without holding an operating license in breach of the terms and conditions of the license. A person guilty of an offence under 426 is liable in conviction on indictment to imprisonment for 14 years or to a fine or to both, and in summary conviction to imprisonment for 12 months or to a level 5 fine for both. This is a part 7 can also matter relating to operating licenses, including but not limited to the term of the operating license, clause 31, the matter that an application for an operating license must contain, clause 32, the general principles that apply in the consideration of an application, clause 33, and the procedure for considering an application, clause 35. Clause 37 makes clear that the Commission may specify conditions that the licensing authority must attach to each operating license or to each operating license falling within a specified class. Clause 39 provides that the Minister may also provide, by way of regulation, the specified conditions to be attached to operating licenses. Clause 7 provides for the requirements for personal licenses, clause 41, and sets out that operating licenses may include conditions relating to the premises in which license activity will be carried out, clause 42, the method by which anything needs to be transported in the course of the license activity, clause 44, and the equipment used, clause 45. Clause 47 provides that all operating licenses are automatically subject to the condition that it does not permit any activity that is not directed solely at medicinal cannabis. Clause 7 also provides for the regulation, clause 63, the new clause 61, the last clause 63, and forfeiture of operating licenses, clause 64. Clause 8 sets out the nature of personal licenses and makes different provisions relating to personal licenses, including the process of application, duration, and fee. Clause 88 of Part 9 establishes that medicinal cannabis licensing appeals tribunal to hear and determine appeals against the various decisions listed in Clause 87, paragraph A to R. Such decisions include, but are not limited to, a decision of the licensing authority in respect of an application for operating license under Clause 32, Clause 87A, and a decision of the Commission, the licensing authority, or the Minister in respect of conditions of operating licenses under Clause 37, 38, or 39. Under Clause 90, a party to a case before the tribunal may appeal the tribunal's decision to the Supreme Court. Part 10 deals with the designation and appointment of enforcement officers and the powers of police and enforcement officers to assess compliance with the provisions of the bill once enacted. Part 11 contains miscellaneous and general provisions of the bill, including provisions relating to basic protection and the power of the minister to make regulations that are considered necessary or expedient to give full effect to the bill once enacted. Schedule 1 defines relevant offences and Schedule 2 and 3 make provision for the Medicinal Cannabis Commission and the Medicinal Cannabis Licensing Appeals Tribunal, respectively. The general rule is predicted that medicinal cannabis as a global business will continue to expand for the foreseeable future, so that we are of the view that this new industry, comprehensively regulated to the highest standards, could well create an innovative and thriving sector of the global economy that could lead to quality employment and export opportunities to different jurisdictions. It is vital that we remain open to such new opportunities to maintain our economic growth. This is underpinned by a firm commitment to private industry, and this will seek to establish the appropriate legal and regulatory architecture to create a robustly regulated medicinal cannabis industry in Gibraltar. Speaker, having discussed the general principles on the merits of the bill, I note that it is the government's strict policy, and I emphasize that only the most reputable businesses should be licensed under the proposed new regime, and that licensed businesses will need to conduct their operations fully in compliance with the licensing framework. Speaker, all of them will have received a copy of the letter, and I apologize, Mr. Speaker, that there have been two copies.
there a latter copy of the Constitution of the first. There was a minor error in the first. That sets out various amendments to the bill which I will take at committee stage. Whereas the draft bill that my record stands for publishing was correct, there were two minor supervisory errors, including the lack of insertion of a comma. The bill and published contains a series of errors in the numbering, and I will seek to correct this at committee stage as set out in the letter. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? Or any other business?
Mr. Speaker, for the members that I speak for on this side of the House, we will support the principles of the bill. As the Minister says, it's recognised, I think, that there are opportunities in this area if the industry is properly regulated, and indeed I tell myself, as someone who clearly sees the distinction between medicinal cannabis and cannabis and drugs generally, that precisely the key is in the word medicinal, and that the difference between prescribed drugs and drugs that are illegal is the control or proper use of drugs. And so if there are any medicinal properties that can be channeled and regulated properly to improve the quality of life of persons administered by lawfully regulated practitioners in the field, then clearly that is something that needs to be looked at and favored. And if there are commercial opportunities that can be developed in Gibraltar on that basis, then also they should be. My cautious side, of course, says that it is important when the government considers opportunities that come its way that it should properly scrutinize them and indeed make sure that only the highest quality, and most reputable proposals that it receives are given the green light. This bill, of course, does not talk to the issue of who should get a specific license, but it provides a regulatory framework, and I certainly welcome what the Minister said towards the latter half of his contribution when he talking at a more general level in relation to the attitude of the government and the architecture that is before the House today, that we agree that whenever you're going to look at an opportunity, a commercial opportunity, and regulate it, the regulatory framework must be robust. I think the lesson has been learned in the area of financial services that, in fact, the more robust and the better your regulation, the more it attracts quality business to financial services. I'm not saying that this is the same, but certainly in terms of regulation, it is certainly better whenever we place ourselves in looking to go to in any room of competition, never to expose ourselves to reputational damage. There are plenty of people outside our shores that would want to come to Gibraltar to accuse us and to tarnish our reputation. So it's certainly important that when we consider these opportunities, it should be against the backdrop of a robust regulatory framework. So we welcome and support the principles. Once the robust regulatory framework is in place, it is then incumbent on those people who are going to administer the regulation, be they in the committees or indeed the government itself, to ensure that only high-quality business arrives in Gibraltar, and that when it arrives, it is properly supervised, so that we do not have abuse of this industry in a way that is not the design and intent of this particular bill, which we welcome, which is to allow people's quality of life to be improved through the proper commercial use of a particular ingredient, Mr. Speaker.
You want to go my own?
Mr. Speaker, I would like to reiterate yet again my support for the legislation of medical cannabis and remind everyone of the form and mockery these ideas were subjected to only 4 years ago when this member brought them to this House. Mr. Speaker, the arrogance and short-sightedness with which these ideas were treated, as well as the disdain for the suffering of the patient who could have been benefiting all this time from the implementation of this legislation, should serve as a lesson in humility for the many members in this House. Let's hope that these kinds of embarrassing episodes do not happen in the future, Mr. Speaker.
Does any other member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? Which case I'll ask the mover of the bill to respond.
Mr. Speaker, I am grateful for the support of the opposition, the whole of the opposition to this initiative. I can assure Mr. Speaker, the honourable leader of the opposition, that no effort has been spared in order to ensure the robustness of the regulatory framework. And the discussions that have gone on in arriving at this bill have been very, very tight. I think that the voter's track record, which the Honourable Leader has recently referred to himself in the regulation of financial services, has stood us, as he has said, in good stead, and our reputation has been upheld. And there is every intention that this should be seriously, robustly, in order to ensure that the voter's reputation in this area, where we hope we will be able to flourish, that will be just as thorough.
I go back. So, thank you. So, I want to take a question which is of a bill to make provision for the regulation of the production, import, export, marketing, and supply of cannabis for medicinal purposes and for commercial purposes be read for a second time. Those in favour will be given carried. The Medicinal Cannabis Act 2021.
The Speaker, I want to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today? A bill for that to amend the Environmental Protection Code Act 2014. The Honourable, the Minister for the Environment, Sustainability, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill for an act to amend the Environmental Protection Code Act 2014 be read a first time.
I will put the question which is of a bill for an act to amend the Environmental Protection Code Act 2014 be read a first time. Those in favour will be granted carried. The Environmental Protection Code Amendment Act 2020.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, in view of the paper, because this has been in view of the paper for some time, the Act 2020 to the committee stage, I will be moving that to change Act 2021. Mr. Speaker, in moving that this Act be read a second time, I would like to say that the purpose of the Act that was recently passed in 2014 was to regulate the management of applications for work relating to provisioning the development and planning commission as a competent authority for such matters. Before talking about the purpose of this particular bill, I think it's important to explain how in practice, within the legal framework currently in place, the applications for work should be administered. An application relating to trees is filed with the Department of Town Planning, rather e-planning portal. The application highlighted by the Department of Town Planning was a sentiment of both officers from our horticultural section and officers from our technical section at the Department of Environment who will deal with this in one of two ways. The application relates to simple routine work involving a full reduction, not exceeding the recommended 20% of the penalty, which will be therefore enhanced by the horticultural section. And for any matters of more significance, after the request for allowing or even for selling, the government specialists are instructed to consider and conduct an assessment of the tree estimates subject to the proposed work. Once the assessment has been carried out, it's documented and submitted for consideration of the minister from the government. The minister then reviews reputation in conjunction with the key assessment, and then grants consent or refuses consent, and refers it back to the applicant through the Department of Town Planning for further consideration. Ultimately, once the determination has been made on the application, the Department of Environment advises the Department of Town Planning. The minister was then raised to pursue it at committee level, that he's able to reach them then from the DPC to bring that, which he recommends as a subcommittee matter for the commission to ratify the determination. And once that determination is confirmed in writing by the commission, the application process is considered to be complete. And Mr. Speaker, it's still an appeal that may be pursued by the applicant. Mr. Speaker, this is a very complex and convoluted way of dealing with it, going back and forth between departments. Mr. Speaker, it's our duty as a public office to continuously build on the efficacy of our working practices for the best betterment of the customer and their dealings with us. And the commission has a known disappointment of the committee for the purpose of this act. Cabinet effect may be serving as a prospect for the Department of the Environment. The London Bill will get referred to a Royal Court 3, invite the Minister for Environment as a new competent authority, and have the surrounding set of justice to read in building legal language across the entire act. Thirdly, Mr. Speaker, and by Royal Court 7, 10, and 13, the amendment serves to clarify the government's position in scenarios where applicants nominate a contractor to undertake work relating to fees on their behalf. The applicant shall continue to bear the responsibility for any work carried out in contravention of this act. This is clear whether the works are ultimately carried out by a contractor or not. In such cases, as written to speaker, where the applicant has been granted consent to carry out the proposed work, the Department of the Environment has undertaken to serve a copy of the determination in writing to the nominated contractor as well. The purpose of this new undertaking is to ensure that all parties understand what has and has not been granted. Please cannot be saying the answer has been cut down, Mr. Speaker, and it's important that we minimize the risk of dreadful mistakes like this when occurring. The Department of the Environment now assumes no responsibility as an enforcement body. As part of the condemning speaker from now on, any summons to be filed in court on behalf of the government to initiate proceedings for offences committed under the act shall be filed by the Department of the Environment. By assuming full enforcement control and continuing the application process from commencement to completion, it allows the department to be in a better position when carrying out these sanctions. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, this new structure not only makes the application process swifter, it's also to make it safer, by minimizing the risk of accidental distortion to any conditions that may be attached to a consent order and almost rest in translation. I think Mr. Speaker, that these are the same measures will assist to protect and preserve students in the process, and I now commend this bill to the House.
The point of the question, does any of the members speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? Under the leader of the opposition,
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister has given a long explanation, but it wasn't present, as he understands in the expansion on landing. Of course, they never are in great detail, but he will forgive me for saying that I'm not sure we can support this bill because there's a lot to tune in what he said, but one of the things that struck me was where he said, well, in practice, the powers vesting the Development and Planning Commission, which is, even though the power is with the Development and Planning Commission, it's really been acting as a postbox for the Minister for the Environment. Now, it may be that, whenever there is a Minister for the Environment who is environmentally friendly or who is very keen on safeguarding heritage of trees, and the incumbent, I'm sure, given his track record, is such a person. But I'm not sure that the principle of removing the Planning Commission as the guardian of trees is a good one, and giving it to the Minister for the Environment, especially who may be someone who doesn't have all the wider considerations that the Planning Commission and the people who staff the Planning Commission have. From time to time, rather than just acting as a postbox, the question that was going through my mind when I was listening to the Honourable Member is why
did the Planning Commission act as a first box, and why isn't it the case that the Planning Commission properly fulfills its function? And even though I accept that there is an element of bureaucracy in everything that the Honourable Minister was doing, and I'm certainly in favour of streamlining and making processes more effective so that trees are preserved and our heritage is protected. So all that I agree with, but is it achieved through the method of the underlying principle concerning the formal power to the Minister for the Environment? I'm certainly not convinced, listening to what the Honourable Member has said, and in that regard, we find it difficult to support the bill, although we certainly support some of the things that the Minister has said.
Thank you, Speaker. Thank you. Similarly to the Liberal opposition, I have my own concern that I wish to highlight, which is that moving the responsibility for the protection of our trees from one politically controlled body to another is not really the change that we need, Mr. Speaker. I mean, should we not be looking at independent bodies to be established to protect our trees, our air, our wildlife? Then we'll be moving towards more collaboration with environmentalists and NGOs on this matter. So the Speaker, these changes might make the running of ourselves more logistically easier and smoother, but I do not believe they will provide the protection that our environment really needs. Especially as the Leader of the Opposition says now, today we have a Minister for the Environment who himself has a lot of experience and skill in environmental matters, but that might not always be the case, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I do not believe it is possible to allow a remark to pass that suggests that the Development and Planning Commission is a politically controlled body. Mr. Speaker, if it is, somebody might like to tell me where the button to control it is, because the government subjects its own projects to the DPC and settles and enjoys the views of the DPC in ensuring that we comply with the guidance and advice we were given when we submitted projects for environmental advice, and today the requirements that may be imposed on the government. And indeed, so do other developers, because whose ideas might have been put to the government, the government might support, but nonetheless find that the DPC requires them to change their projects, which is what the DPC, an independent statutory body, is designed to do. So, Mr. Speaker, I think it is a little unacceptable for the Honourable Lady to refer to the DPC as a politically controlled body, and to say that to go from the DPC to a minister, the guardian of horticulture, the tree, is to go from one politically controlled body to another. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, then one might argue that there is no need or relevance in having elections, because you just go from one set of politically elected people to another set of politically elected people, all of whom, in the context of the things that we learned from the Honourable Lady today, are all susceptible just to a decent election, unless, of course, it happens to be here. So, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady will understand that the government is not going to be persuaded by the arguments that she has put, which are devoid of any merit, that anybody that might give any thought to what she has said might be able to highlight on. And those things may be popular to say. Politicians, apart from lawyers and as one-time bankers and real estate agents, but probably the people who are easiest to hit. But they're also, Mr. Speaker, inter alia, some of the people who work hardest for our community, whichever side of the house we may be sitting on. So going back to the idea, Mr. Speaker, that Tony Blair said on the day that he left politics, that yes, of course, your politics can be the place of low skullduggery, he said, but it is also the place of the pursuit of the noblest purposes. Otherwise, why are we here, Mr. Speaker? And those of us who believe in those noblest purposes, and who believe, Mr. Speaker, that a Minister of the Environment, whoever he or she may be, in particular, Jim Cook, but whoever he or she may be, who is charged with an oath to ministerial office, and that ministerial office is the protection of the environment, would be undoubtedly the best person to be the guardian
of that part of the horticulture which the Honourable Gentleman has thought to take. And the Speaker, if Honourable Members think that is not the case, they need to ask themselves, what elements they would bring to the office of Minister for the Environment. Is it that they are saying that they do not trust themselves with this power, Mr. Speaker? Because let's be clear. How can a Minister for the Environment do anything other than protect the trees which the Honourable Member is suggesting to come under his decision? And given that Honourable Members have said that they believe that Mr. Fassett is a person with experience, that they believe he is a person who does have the best interest of our wildlife, our environment, our horticulture, and our food in mind, do they change their view if I tell them that this is entirely a bill of the making of the Minister for the Environment? In other words, he who has that concern thinks that the government should move this bill as a government bill and give him the responsibility and his successes the responsibility. So, the person they say they respect as having that concern for the environment is the mover, indeed, who is the originator, not just the mover, of the bill for the purpose. And the Speaker, therefore, and I must put it to Honourable Members, that they should, for one moment at least, stop their cynicism. I'm afraid I don't think you all really can. But I invite Honourable Members, other Honourable Members who haven't approached this debate, as the Honourable Lady has, to for one moment challenge themselves, to park their cynicism, to believe in themselves and in the noble purposes that are the ones that must have proposed us to be in this profession for one moment, and to realise that giving a minister a power to protect something is not a license to not protect those things, quite the opposite. Unless, of course, Mr. Speaker, their cynicism is deeper than I imagine, and they don't ever believe that they would be able to appoint a man to the Minister for the Environment who would do the job that this man would do, or any woman who might be appointed to that job in the future.
Mr.
Speaker, there must be some inconsistency somewhere, and that's not that many minutes ago. The position that there is a bill for medicinal cannabis, which in fact plays a very minimal white powers, and if they're going to question every time the minister is given responsibility, then I don't know, I question the notion that I'm in fact disappointed in a way that encouraged in order. Mr. Speaker, I can assure the House that this will streamline the process in order to protect trees. I know that I have the support of the Honourable Minister for Town Planning and his department. There will be an independent professional assessment of every tree. So there is that independence. The Town Planning department and the DPC don't have the expertise required and therefore have to call upon the Department of the Environment to carry out this assessment and to make these recommendations and indeed to supervise that the trees are being dealt with in the way that it has been decided they should be following the expert consultation. Mr. Speaker, I do take this role as a vote of confidence on behalf of the opposition in my office, and I've been wanting to ensure, therefore, that trees continue to be protected in this way. I urge you to ensure that I continue as Minister for the Environment for many years to come, together with the rest of my colleagues in Ireland.
I put the question, which is a debating match from the Environmental Protection Fees Act 2014, be read the second time. Those in favour? Those against? So the opposition is voting against the second reading. Does the Honourable Member have time to be voting in favour or against? In favour.
Environmental Protection Trees Amendment Act 2020. The Speaker, I would like to give notice that the committee says on third reading that the bill be taken together with all Honourable Members agree.
Do all Honourable Members agree that the committee says on third reading that the bill be taken together? committee stage and third reading. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House now resolve itself into committee to consider the following bills clause by clause, namely the Australian Amendment Brief. So the Environmental Protection Treaties Amendment Bill 2020, the Medicinal Cannabis Act 2020, the Petroleum Amendment Number 2 Bill 2021, the Registered Property Occupation Bill 2021, the Data Sharing Public Authorities Act 2021, the Traffic Amendment Bill 2020, and that's it. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. A bill for an act to amend the Environmental Protection Treaty Act 2014. Clauses 1 to 3. Let me just say, a bill for an act to make provisions for the regulation, the production, import, export, marketing, and supply of cannabis for medicinal purposes and for medical purposes. Once again, I will talk to you about the 22nd of September request to get some minor amendments in one case and the introductory arrangement of clauses that can be amended.
Are the members of the content of the amendment?
Part 1, clauses 1 to 3. Part 2, clauses 4 to 8. Clause 9, as amended.
I'm as a member of the party to vote.
Part 3, clauses 10 to 13.
Not just clause 10. We have to read that clause 10 to 10 part of the vote. In the arrangement.
Clauses 11 to 13. 11 to 13 is part of the vote. Part 4, clauses 10, clauses 14 to 22. Four clauses 14 to 22 is part of the vote. Part 5, clause 23. Clause 23, to the start of the bill. Clause 24, as amended. 24, as amended, to the start of the bill. Clause 25, to the start of the bill. Part 6, clauses 26 to 29. Part 7,
clauses 30 to 73. Part 7, clauses 30 to 73, and part of the vote. Part 8, clauses 74 to 85. Clauses 74 to 85, seven part of the vote. Part 9, clauses 86 to 90. Mainly clauses 86 to 90, seven part of the vote. Part 10, clauses 91 to 105. Part 10, clauses 91 to 105, 7 part of the bill. Part 11, clauses 106 to 113. Part 11, clauses 106 to 113, 7 part of the bill. Schedule 1, 7 part of the bill. Schedule 2, 7 part of the bill. Schedule 3, 7 part of the bill. The long title, stands part of the bill. A bill for an act to amend the Petroleum Act to provide for an increase in certain penalties and for collective purposes. Clauses 1 to 4. 1 to 4 stands part of the bill. The long title. The long title stands part of the bill. A bill for an act to make provision for the establishment of a register of property occupation, the appointment of a registrar responsible for maintaining the register of property occupation, the creation and appointment of an appeals board, and for collective purposes. Clauses 1 and 2. Clauses 1 and 2 stand part of the bill. Clause 3 as amended. Clause 3 as amended stand part of the bill. Clause 4 as amended. Clause 4 as amended stands part of the bill. New clauses 16 to 18. New clauses 16 to 18 stand part of the bill. The long title. The long title stands part of the bill. A bill for an act to provide for the regulation of the sharing of information, including personal data between public bodies, to provide for the regulation of the management of information by public bodies, and to provide for related matters. Part 1, clauses 1 to 3. Part 1, clauses 1 to 3, stand part of the bill. Part 2, clauses 4 to 8. Part 2, clauses 4 to 8, stand part of the bill. Part 3, clauses 9 to 15. Part 3, clauses 9 to 15, stand part of the bill. Schedule 1, the 1 stand part of the bill. Schedule 2, schedule 2 stand part of the bill. The long title, the long title stand part of the bill. A bill to amend the Traffic Act 2005. Clauses 1 and 2.
Mr. Chairman, the assistant amendments, one of them is the date of the bill, 2020 to 2021, and there is also an amendment originally made by the then Minister for Business, Trade and Transport and the Port, and that was in effect according to section after the section 2A. And maybe a letter of guidance issued under Section 1 that was valid on the 1st of December 2020 will expire date before the 1st of March 2021 is deemed to be valid until the 1st of March 2021 because of the time taken to do the bill to Parliament that's no longer applicable. So only the second, the two amendments after that are still applicable, not the first.
Could we go through that once again? In the memorandum, which was signed by Minister Galliani, we are asked to insert after subsection 4, CD. What are we saying here? That CD is
the is no longer applicable because time has passed beyond the 31st of March 2021, so it's been the next to include that amendment as part of the bill.
Right, so 3C becomes 3B?
Yes.
And so on, 3B becomes 3C.
Yes.
Are the members of the opposition content with the amendment?
As amended, the wrong title,
all topics to be part of the bill.
The Honourable Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I'm going to report that the following bills have been considered in committee and agreed to read amendments, and I now move that they be read a third time and passed, namely the Medicinal Cannabis Act 2021, the Environmental Protection Trees Amendment Bill 2020, the Petroleum Amendment Number 2 Bill 2021, the Registered Property Occupation Bill 2021, the Data Store and Public Authorities Act 2021, the Census Amendment Bill 2020.
I now put the question, which is that the Environmental Protection Trees Amendment Bill 2021, the Medicinal Cannabis Act 2021, the Petroleum Amendment Number 2 Bill 2021, the Registered Property Occupation Bill 2021, and the Data Store and Public Authorities Act 2021 being read a third time and passed. Those in favour of the Environmental Protection Fees Amendment Bill 2021? Those against? The only one that has signed on is you. So the Queen. Those in favour of the Medicinal Cannabis Bill 2021, those against, those in favour, those against, carried. Those in favour of the Petroleum Amendment Number 2 Bill 2021, those against, carried. Those in favour of the Registered Property Occupation Bill 2021, those against, carried. Those in favour of the Registered Property Occupation Public Authorities Bill 2021, those against, carried. Those in favour of the Census Amendment Bill 2021, those against, carried. May I just go back and ask about the Registered Property Occupation? I think the second reading stage, one of the members said that he would, or he thought it would be voting or abstaining for it. You get the service. That goes out there. No, I never choose anything.
I was going to remove the adjournment of the idea, but I give way to another gentleman I think wants to make a mention of the motion.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, we have still pending on the agenda the motion in my name on the Mental Health Select Committee. But I had agreed with the Minister for Health and discussing it with my colleague, Mr. Hassan Ryan, who also supported the motion that we would await and consider the mental health strategy that the government was published and that we would take the motion at the next sitting of the House. The Minister for Health is not here, so we would be grateful to take it at the next sitting of the House.
And Mr. Speaker, that was my understanding as well, I know that the Honourable Minister for Health and the Honourable Gentleman have spoken and are speaking about the matters that he has raised in that measure. Mr. Speaker, I know that the House would now join senior view.
I'd like to pose the question that is that this House will now adjourn at senior view. I now put the question that is that this House will now adjourn at senior view. Are those in favour? Those against? This House will now adjourn at senior view.